Good afternoon. I will call to order this remote hearing of the House Commerce Committee and ask Mr. Dockendorf to take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Present.
Vice Chair Cotiza Watoon.
Present.
Representative O'Driscoll.
O'Driscoll present.
Representative Barr.
Here.
Representative Carlson. Representative Dabney.
Dabney present.
Representative Elkins.
Elkins present.
Representative Haley.
Haley present.
Representative Cagle.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lilly. Representative Lislegard.
Oh, Lislegard here.
Representative Lucero.
Yes, sir.
Representative Olson.
Present.
Representative Farr.
Farr present.
Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen present.
Representative Richardson.
Present.
Representative Tice. And Representative Carlson. Representative Lilly.
We have a quorum. The first item of business is approval of our minutes from March 22nd, 2022. Representative Cotiza Watoon, do you have a motion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would move yesterday's minutes from the March 22nd.
Vice Chair Cotiza Watoon moves approval of the minutes from March 22nd, 2022. Any discussion to that motion? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes from March 22nd, 2022 are approved. The first item on our agenda is House File 3768 from Representative Cagle. Representative Cagle, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move House File 3767 to the General Register.
3768?
Yes.
3768. Representative Cagle moves House File 3768 be recommended be placed on the General Register. Representative Cagle, to your bill.
All right, so imagine that you are in a horrific accident. It's not your fault. It leaves you seriously and permanently injured and perhaps cognitively impaired, and you win a settlement for $2 million. But rather than take the lump sum award, your attorney advises you to have the insurance company paying out the claim, to work with an annuity company to set up what's called a structured settlement, which consists of installment payments over perhaps the rest of your life. This way, you are assured that the necessity of life and future medical needs will be taken care of, not only for you, but also for your children. In the 1990s, an industry emerged whose goal it was to induce you to part with the money you will receive over your life for a single payment now, typically for a much lower amount than it's worth in present day dollars. These companies are called settlement purchasing or factoring companies. And whenever you're watching Price is Right, you might have seen the advertisement for one of the biggest purchasing companies screaming at viewers, "It's my money and I want it now," or the one with the 877 cash now. So those are the companies we're talking about. By the late 1990s, the aggressive and often abusive tactics of this industry led the passage in all 50 states, including Minnesota, of the Structured Settlement Protection Act. This act was intended to protect these vulnerable, often unsophisticated, and often cognitively impaired potential sellers from being taken advantage of. The law established an unprecedented court approval process for these deals. In few, if any, areas is it necessary for a court to approve a marketplace transaction between a buyer and a seller. That one was set up here, tells you everything you need to know about the dangers inherent to selling in these situations. In October 2021, the Star Tribune published a shocking investigative series about the predatory practices of many of the biggest players in the structured settlement purchasing industry. I don't know if this is in your packets, but there were some excerpts provided, and if they're on your packets, I can get them to you. The revelations from this series are appalling. So let me just go over a couple that the articles revealed. First, sellers get an inordinately small percentage of the present value of their settlements. The series reported on an average seller only receiving 40% of their future payments in cash. One Lino Lakes resident whose skull was partially crushed when a 1,200-pound concrete sewer culvert rolled over on him, left him without most of his teeth, blind in one eye, and his face permanently scarred. He never finished high school and was induced to sell his settlement, and he will not receive another check until he's almost 80 years old. Altogether, he sold $1.5 million in payments to one of the biggest purchasing companies for $226,000. So that's about 25% of what it was actually worth. Many of the victimized are sellers are kids turning 18 who received their settlement because of an injury sustained as minors. And now they're being bombarded with calls and texts offering quick cash. It also revealed, the series also revealed that existing law, including disclosure requirements passed in 2014, are having little impact. Judges indicate that the current law is vague with no standards or formal guidelines in the process. They're crying out for legislation to provide clear guidance and tools to enable them to determine whether the terms of these deals are fair and reasonable, and whether the overall transaction is in fact in the best interest of the seller. The series also identified aggressive marketing techniques bordering on and sometimes crossing the line into harassment. Dozens of calls a day, a consistent stream of mail solicitations, mailing with documents that look like checks that if you sign, you agree to sell your settlement. So House File 3768 provides desperately needed reform from this 1999 law to address these unconscionable situations. Does not outlaw the purchase of a structured settlement. What House File 3768 does is better protect against a seller being taken advantage of. So what it does is it gives judges the tools and standards they need to accurately determine that these deals are fair and reasonable and in the best interest of the seller, gives judge the discretion to appoint an outside evaluator to assess the deal and give independent counsel to the judge as whether or not to approve the sale. It also establishes a set formula to ensure that no one will be taken advantage of by selling their settlement for next to nothing. Sets guardrails against abusive and harassing marketing techniques that are common. And the good news is that one of the trade associations that represents a portion of the industry has come forward with their ideas and reform on our law and to better protect our consumers. We've been working collaboratively to make sure we get reform done this session. And I just wanted to thank them and say I appreciate that they reached out to me and offered to try and combine our efforts to make a really good bill. I had to change my metaphor a little bit here, so stay with me a second. I would say that we are all in the soup aisle of the grocery store, just haven't agreed on whether we want chicken noodle or tomato. So before I turn it over to my testifiers, I just want to read a quote from the Star Tribune series from a person who spent 3 years soliciting deals at one of the industry leaders. She said that she believes settlement purchasers prey on people in desperate situations. Even though some clients are not in the right state of mind, it just didn't sit right with her. With the help of the industry, we will set things right here in Minnesota. And so with that, I will turn it over to my testifiers.
Next biennium, I think we will have to consider changing the name of the committee to the Commerce, Soup, Finance, and Policy Committee. We have an all-star panel here of some of the finest people who appear before the Commerce Committee, so we'll just get right to it. First is Attorney General Keith Ellison. Attorney General Ellison, welcome back to the Commerce Committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for having me. I want to thank you. I want to thank Vice Chair Katsia Watun, and I want to also thank Ranking Member O'Driscoll, and I want to thank our author who's introduced an excellent piece of legislation. But thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 3768. This bill will substantially strengthen consumer protections and provide clear standards to Minnesota courts when reviewing whether or not to approve the transfer of a consumer's future structured settlement payments in exchange for a one-time lump sum payment. As we all now know from a Star Tribune series last October, about structured settlements and the often abusive practices of some companies that purchase them from people. Sometimes, for pennies on the dollar, Minnesotans who receive structured settlements are often the victims of catastrophic and permanent injuries that restrict their ability to support themselves and their families for the rest of their lives. Some victims suffer from cognitive impairments, mental health problems, or addiction. The structured settlement payments that they receive, sometimes totaling hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars, are intended to provide for them with ongoing support for decades or even the rest of their lives. Yet, as I said, some of these settlement purchase companies prey on these consumers by hounding them with solicitations, pressuring them to sell their right to future settlement payments for only a small fraction of what they are guaranteed to receive. The all too common result is that these permanently injured Minnesotans who enter these transactions are left without the means to afford their lives and live with dignity, safety, and respect. That means they often have to be taken care of by taxpayers and other people in philanthropy when it was the responsibility of the folks who injured them in the first place to do that. Minnesota's existing Structured Settlement Act simply doesn't go far enough to protect consumers from predatory practices in settlement purchasing companies. House File 3768 will change that by amending the Structured Settlements Act. Some of the provisions that I believe are important and have had a chance to look at include allowing the court to appoint an evaluator to provide an independent assessment of the proposed transaction. Also, providing clearer guidelines to the court to determine whether a proposed transaction is fair, reasonable, and in the best interest of consumers and their dependents. Also, preventing court forum shopping by settlement purchase companies and by prohibiting predatory practices that settlement purchase companies engage in. These protections are important to end the practice of those bad actor settlement purchaser companies who prey upon vulnerable consumers and ensuring that any proposed transfers of future structured settlement payments are fair, reasonable, and in the best interest of permanently impaired Minnesotans. I want to thank the author, Aaron Cagle. Aaron, thank you for your hard work. Representative, you have lived up to the title public servant today with this bill. Good luck, and I hope we pass it.
Thank you, Mr. Attorney General. Our next testifier is Ron Elwood. Mr. Elwood.
Sorry, Mr. Chair. I'm going to donate my time to the rest of the testifiers in the interest of expediency. I'm just around for questions today. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. The next testifier is Joel Carlson. Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'm Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm again in front of your committee on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice, a group I've represented since 1994, and way before Attorney General Ellison was a legislator. We've been coming before you to find ways to receive compensation for people who've been injured through other people's negligence. The people that are in that Star Tribune article, that's who we represent. And I agree with Mr. Elwood after the author and the Attorney General kind of ran through the bill. You just need to know that it is hard work to obtain these settlements. And this money is intended to last the injured party a lifetime and for their family. And we see and we've seen the sale of those settlements for pennies on the dollar. It isn't cringeworthy, as the Star Tribune pointed out. It's disgusting. And we really hope that we can get this bill passed. I would point out a couple of the things that are in the bill that we think are very important. And just to put an exclamation point on it, the appointment of an independent evaluator by the court is something that has proven to be effective. Albuquerque, New Mexico judges have been doing this routinely, and they have found that many cases don't even get to them once they appoint an evaluator, and only 42% of them are approved once they actually get to the court. We think that really helps. The last consumer protection that wasn't mentioned that I would like to mention is that the bill requires that the disclosure to the consumer comes to them as an effective equivalent interest rate. And what that says, and it's defined in the bill on page one and the top of page two, is that you have to tell the consumer, if you were borrowing this money from us, this is the interest rate you would be paying. And I can tell you, when you tell consumers that that car loan is going to be 420%, they're not going to enter into that transaction. We think that's a very important protection. It was also noted, and I want to also applaud several in the industry that have come forward to bring a bill forward, and Representative Katiza Watoon has that bill. I think that we are going to work in partnership to get this done and be a strong bill for consumers. Appreciate your support and happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Our next testifier is Robin Rowan. Ms. Rowan.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Robin Rowan with the Minnesota Insurance and Financial Services Council, and we are strongly in support of Representative Cagle's bill. So in the world of structured settlements, life insurers are the annuity issuers. So once the parties to the original lawsuit agree on a payment plan to take care of the needs of the tort victim, the annuity contract is purchased to fund the payments. So when the tort victim sells their payments to a factoring company or a settlement purchasing company, the life insurer's obligation to pay doesn't change, and neither does the tax-free status of those payments. So when settlement companies purchase the tort victim payments, they are often resold and securitized. So if you think about mortgage-backed securities without the risk of default, because companies like Prudential and MetLife aren't going to default. So you can see why the factoring companies are interested in buying up the tort victim payments and why they need so many. But we do understand that there may be times when a tort victim needs to sell their payments. However, we are concerned that the abuses by the factoring companies and the often rubber stamping of the payment sales by the courts will undermine the viability of structured settlements. So as Mr. Carlson mentioned, it can take months or sometimes years to put together a comprehensive plan designed to meet the unique health and economic security needs of a tort victim. And the plan is usually necessary because the victim may not be able to responsibly manage a giant lump sum payment. But if the victims end up selling their settlements for payments on the dollar and they're only getting a portion of the original awarded settlement, then the structured settlements are simply not serving the purpose for which they are designed. And that's why we think it's imperative to enact provisions that give judges the tools they are asking for, such as the ability to appoint an independent evaluator, which several people have mentioned so far. But that evaluator will help the judge determine whether the payment that the tort victim is getting is in their best interest and whether it's a fair and reasonable deal. And we also think the specific and comprehensive criteria to help the court in evaluating whether the sale is in the best interest of the tort victim are absolutely critical. So, again, I want to thank Representative Cagle for bringing the bill and also the good people from NASP, which represent the settlement providers, for coming to the table. And like the others, I'm confident we will come to a solution that's in the best interest of Minnesotans and preserve structured settlements as an option for the care of tort victims. So thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And then our last testifier is Sarah Strong-Belisle. Ms. Strong-Belisle.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair members. Thank you. My name is Sarah Strong-Belisle with Cook Girard Associates here in St. Paul. I'm here today on behalf of the National Association of Settlement Purchasers, or NASP, to offer some comments on Rep. Hagel's bill. NASP is the only trade association representing structured settlement purchase companies. Their membership is comprised of 11 companies which originate structured settlement transfers here in Minnesota and across the country. For over 25 years, the organization has participated in every state legislature and in Congress, helping to craft the laws and legislation which govern these transactions. Additionally, in cooperation with the National Structured Settlement Trade Association, they've worked together with the National Conference of Insurance Legislators to establish and periodically update the NCOIL Model Structured Settlement Protection Act, which serves as the framework for many state statutes across the country. NASP members have witnessed both the benefits associated with these transactions and, unfortunately, the great damage that bad actors in the marketplace can cause, as highlighted by the articles published last year. They were deeply troubled by some of the allegations raised against a number of companies, which are not members of NASP, and their alleged conduct in Minnesota. They were also concerned by comments made by members of the judiciary that they lacked the necessary tools to properly review these cases. We understand there's an immediate need to update and amend Minnesota's current law for the benefit of structured settlement recipients, and we are here to join and assist in that effort. We've been engaged in constructive dialogue with Representative Cagle and the other stakeholders that are with us today. While we cannot support the bill in the form in front of you right now, we are confident we will reach an agreement on a proposal that accomplishes our shared goals of greater consumer protections, preventing bad actors from taking advantage of Minnesotans, while maintaining the ability to conduct these transactions in a fair and transparent manner. I just really want to thank Representative Cagle and the other stakeholders. They've done significant work on this, and Representative Cagle for her willingness to invite NASP to be at the table as you craft the legislation. We look forward to continuing this work together. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That concludes public testimony. So we will now move to member discussion and questions. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There are some provisions in the bill that give me concern, but I appreciate that the bill author is working with stakeholders to ensure appropriate structured settlement purchases can continue in Minnesota. There are instances, or at least I believe there are instances where structured settlements can make sense for individuals, but we also need to improve our law to make sure that we're protecting consumers from bad actors in this marketplace that we've talked about today. And so just wanted to make those comments on the bill and appreciate the conversation. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. Any other discussion to the bill? Seeing none, Representative Cagle, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just really want to thank everybody who's been a part of this legislation. I joked in a previous committee that this is my, I just cut three fingers off. Now I need a lot of work to do, Bill. And so I really, really do appreciate all the stakeholders and the Senate engaging in this. And I think we will get something done. So thank you so much.
Well, Representative Cagle, I appreciate the work that you've done on this bill. And as I said to you when we were initially talking about it, I think you have a unique perspective about how a moment can change someone's life forever. That is pretty valuable in the context of talking about this particular bill. So I appreciate the work that you've been doing on it. With that, Representative Cagle renews her motion that House File 3768 be recommended to be placed on the general register, and Mr. Dockendorf will take the roll.
Chair Stevenson.
Aye.
Stevenson, aye. Vice Chair Cotiza Watoon.
Aye.
Cotiza Watoon, aye. Representative O'Driscoll.
O'Driscoll, no.
O'Driscoll, no. Representative Barr.
No.
Barr, no. Representative Carlson. Representative Dabney.
Dabney, aye.
Dabney, aye. Representative Elkins.
Elkins, aye.
Elkins, aye. Representative Haley. Representative Haley.
Haley, aye.
Haley, aye. Representative Cagle.
Aye.
Cagle, aye. Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Lee, aye. Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Lilly, aye. Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, aye.
Lislegard, aye. Representative Lucero.
Lucero, no.
Lucero, no. Representative Olson.
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Farr.
Farr, aye.
Farr, aye. Representative Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, aye.
Rasmussen, aye. Representative Richardson.
Richardson, aye.
Richardson, aye. Representative Tice.
Tice, aye.
Tice, aye.
With 14 ayes and 3 nays, the motion prevails, and House File 3768 is recommended to be placed on the general register. Thank you, Representative Cagle. The next item on our agenda today is House File 2824. Representative Lee, would you like to move your bill?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move my bill, House File 2824, to be considered for possible inclusion in the bill. If that's the right motion, Mr. Chair.
It is the correct motion. Representative Lee moves House File 2824 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And I understand you have an amendment. It's the A22 amendment, I believe.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have the A22 amendment.
And Representative Lee moves the A22 amendment. Do you want to briefly describe the amendment? I assume this just gets you in the shape you want us to consider it.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right. Representative Chair Lee has the A22 amendment to get the bill in the shape he'd like us to consider it. Any discussion to the A22? Seeing none, all in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the A22 amendment is adopted. Chair Lee, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members, for the opportunity to present House File 2824 as amended. Mr. Chair, this is a proposal that was brought forth to me by the Council of Latino Affairs, you know, presenting some of the issues that some of the folks that they've been working with regarding, you know, I think consumer protection on price disclosure. And so just wanted to make sure that as we move forward in the state, you know, car dealerships have information available to help out consumers as they make the decision whether they want to purchase a vehicle or not. And so the bill requires dealerships to provide the price of the vehicle before the consumer expressed interest or engage in the transaction of purchasing a car. And we define, you know, what displaying the vehicle price is, you know, around having large print of the vehicle windshield, indicating the price on the website or any other means to provide the consumer adequate notice of the price of the vehicle before purchasing. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it over to my testifiers who could actually share some of their experiences.
Thank you, Chair Lee. We do have a number of testifiers, and I believe my understanding is that these testifiers are going to speak with the help of a translator. And are going to speak generally not just about this bill, but the remaining three bills on the agenda, so that they only have to testify the one time. And I believe that we have here to translate for us Felipe Ilescas. Is that correct? Are you on the call?
I am, Mr. Chair. Yes, that is correct. I will be translating. So the testifier will read her testimony in Spanish, and then I will read it again in English.
Wonderful. So the first testifier is Heidi Valeria. Ms. Valeria.
Buenas tardes, miembros del comité. Mi nombre es Heidi Varela. Este testimonio aplica a las propuestas de ley HF 2824 y HF 2825. Hace un tiempo fui a un dealer, no sé si quieren que diga el nombre o no, pero es un dealer que pretende ofrecer buenos autos a precios bajos y ofrecen $2,500 a $3,500 por un automóvil de intercambio. Mi familia y yo llegamos al dealer y como no hablamos mucho inglés, nos recibió alguien que habla español y me pidió una identificación, así que se la di. Mi familia y yo revisamos su inventario y encontramos a un automóvil que parecía satisfacer nuestras necesidades de nuestra familia. Preguntamos varias veces cuánto costaba el carro, pero decían, no sé, 22 a 25 mil, no estamos seguros, tengo que checar. Así que empezaron a correr mi crédito, aunque todo era en inglés y aún sin decirme el precio del auto. Luego regresamos aproximadamente a una hora más tarde con todo el papeleo y dijeron, aquí tienes que firmar. Y dije, espera, un momento, pero ¿cuánto cuesta el carro? A estas alturas todavía no me habían dicho el precio del coche. En ese momento finalmente me dijeron el precio del auto, que era alrededor de los $25,000 y con una tasa de interés de casi el 25%. Les dije que esa tasa de interés era muy alto, pero me dijeron que era para lo que calificaba. Pero que siempre podía refinanciar más adelante. Hicieron ver la situación como si realmente no tenía otra opción. Nunca me revelaron el precio del auto hasta el final. Terminé firmando el papeleo y el proceso parecía muy fácil. Terminé teniendo problemas al otro día con el auto, al día después de comprarlo. Lo devolví y al dealer y me dijeron que estaba todo bien. Luego pedí que me devolvieran el pago inicial y me dijeron que no podían recuperarlo porque había firmado un documento en el que renunciaba al derecho a recuperar el pago inicial. Aquí fue que me di cuenta de que terminé firmando cosas que no entendía y que no me explicaron. Las personas me dijeron que era su dealer y que podían hacer lo que quisieran en ese dealer. y que si no me iba, llamarían a la policía. Terminé dejándome dinero allí porque no quería volver a ese lugar. Perdí mi dinero. Tal vez no era mucho, pero es dinero que pagamos con mucho, que ganamos con mucho trabajo. Es por eso que necesitamos tener leyes que aseguren que los dealers no puedan seguir haciéndonos esto a nuestra gente. Espero que todos los miembros del comité apoyen este proyecto y eviten que más habitantes de Minnesota se conviertan en víctimas como yo y mi familia. Gracias.
Thank you, Mr. Yescas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll be translating. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Heidi Varela. This testimony applies to House File 2824 and House File 2825. Some time ago, I went to a dealership. I don't know if you want me to say the name or not, but it is a dealership who claims to offer good cars at a low price, and they offer $2,500 to $3,000 for a trading car. My family and I arrived at the dealership, and since we do not speak much English, we were greeted by someone that speaks Spanish, and he asked for an ID, so I gave him an ID. My family and I looked through their inventory and found a car that seemed to fulfill the needs for our family. We asked several times how much the car cost, but they would say, I don't know, $22,000 or $25,000. We're not sure. I have to check. So they started running my credit, even though everything was happening in English and still without telling me the price of the car. Then they came back about an hour later with all the paperwork and said, here you go, you have to sign. And I said, wait a minute, but how much is the car? At this point, they still hadn't told me the price of the car. They finally told me the price of the car, which was close to $25,000 and with an interest rate of almost 25%. I told them that that interest rate was very high, but they said that that was what I qualified for, but that I could always refinance later. They made it seem like I didn't really have a choice. They never revealed the price of the car until the very end. I ended up signing the paperwork and the process seemed very easy. I ended up having issues with the car the day after buying it and brought the car back to the dealership and they said, okay. Then I asked for my down payment back and they said that I couldn't get it back because I had signed a paper waiving the right to get my down payment back. The person told me that it was his dealership and he could do whatever he wanted in his dealership. And if I didn't leave, he would call the police. I ended up leaving my money there because I didn't want to go back to that place. I lost my money. Maybe it wasn't much, but it is money that we earned with a lot of work. This is why we need to have laws that ensure that dealerships cannot keep doing this to our people. I hope that all members of the committee will support this bill and prevent more Minnesotans from becoming victims like me and my family. Thank you.
Thank you. And then, Mr. Brown, we have Wilger Ortega on the list. And you don't note that Mr. Ortega is here. Do we have Mr. Ortega?
He might be having tech issues because he was going to join from his phone. So we can either skip him or I can read his testimony.
I think if that's the case, you can submit the testimony in writing if Mr. Ortega is not here, and we will distribute it to committee members.
Sounds good. We'll do
if
that.
He appears later, we can return to him. The next testifier is Jessica Aliaga Frelke, and I don't have you down as needing translation. Is that correct?
That's correct, sir.
All right. Thank you. You can proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jessica Aliaga Frelke. I own Hispanic Solutions Group. I have been in the borrow collections, student loans, and credit for 19 years. During this time, my work is focuses on educating in the process of obtaining credit and the responsibilities that it is entails. But I found myself with a harsh and sad reality. Misleading practice in the car sales is huge. I see almost every day paper from clients, from my customers, people, regular people, they ask me to help regarding this process. The misleading practice in the car sales targeting low income in communities of color, especially immigrants. For years, I have knocked on doors for do something to be done. What I found goes beyond the transaction. It can be said that what they are doing to people is beyond ethics and the least. The lies in the process, lack of transparency in the place they offer. The yo-yo practice, they are just to take people's money. Completely vulnerable people who were cut with false advertisers like everybody qualify without revealing what does it mean. Never disclose the price or what they do. The car sometimes was already sold, but back online the next day. We speak their language, but the buyers don't participate in the financial transaction because everything is handled by the seller, which creates a bigger problem because the buyer doesn't know how the charge that are being added to it incomes. It comes to light after a month because the bank sent the correct invoice. This generates a very great economic pressure because it's not the payment was agreed upon. This generates a credit and economic impact. We have seen people by now not able to pay the bill or the debt, which itself originate with a deception, generate a great problem, such as judgment, loss of savings, and the disruption of their credit. What I found is not against any industry. It's not against the automobile industry. It's against the bad actors, those who abuse community of color. Here I can prove, I have a lot of people, they can testify that they are scary for the tactics from some dealers. I'm not talking about absolutely all the dealers. This is pure financial exploitation. In a time when we are talking about economics, I don't see any reason why somebody will be against protecting the basic rights of consumers and community of colors. I'm here to testify to apply for the House File 2824, 2825, and 2823.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I'm just going to ask, is Wilger Ortega on the line? There's a person who's identified as iPhone there. Mr. Ortega?
Okay. I think he is there.
Well, he's not answering. If he comes back, we will try again. Until then, we'll go next to Amber Backus. Ms. Backus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Amber Backus. I'm the Vice President of Public Affairs with the Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association, which represents 375 franchise new car and truck dealers across the state. Before I address testimony on House File 2824, if I may, Mr. Chairman, I would like to provide some overarching comments on all three bills before you today. I do want to thank Mr. Yescas for taking the time to share the background on the bills with me and describe the situations that prompted their introduction. No consumer should be treated the way his constituents were. It's devastating to hear that they were preyed upon by unscrupulous people who took advantage of language barriers and their economic status to make a few more bucks. I also appreciate that Mr. Yescas reported that none of these incidents occurred at the stores of our franchise new car member dealers, but were limited to a handful of shady actors who operate on the margins. Our association prides itself on our advertising standards program administered by the Better Business Bureau that subjects our members to meeting more rigorous advertising standards than required by federal or state law. That being said, we oppose these proposed bills, not because we're against more consumer protection, but because they cast a wide net and subject all dealerships to standards that are overly broad and in some instances impossible to meet. How do you get a consumer's signature on a written disclosure before they ever become a customer and step foot in your store, as the amendment to House File 2823 would require? We are against setting up our members for failure by putting them into regulatory limbo and exposing them to potential litigation because they cannot meet the requirements of these bills. We did offer revisions to all three bills to eliminate ambiguous language and vague thresholds to ensure our dealers would comply with the regulations while giving consumers additional protections. Unfortunately, those suggestions were largely rejected and are not reflected in the amendments before you today. With regard to the bill before you right now, House File 2824, as amended, our concerns are as follows and primarily relates to ambiguous language. The new language that requires the price to be displayed before filling out a credit application seems to provide a distinction between cash and finance deals. From a policy perspective, we're wondering why or how a consumer pays matters and how the price is advertised, especially since it's illegal under federal law to offer a different price for cash paying customers than one using financing. We are also concerned about the terms prominent and now conspicuous that has been added to the bill, as they can take on many forms, making them both hard to interpret and enforce. But we do appreciate the removal of the word equivalent on line 12, as that was another ambiguous term from a compliance perspective. So with that, I'll conclude my testimony on this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to make one more attempt here. Is Wilger Ortega on the Zoom? And I do not see Mr. Ortega. So that concludes public testimony on this bill. We will move to members' discussion and question. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've got four questions for the bill author. The first question I have is on line 1.7, 1.8, it says use motor vehicles. So does this, I just want to confirm that this provision does not apply to new vehicles. Is that correct?
Chair Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is correct.
Representative Lucero.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So then I guess a follow-up to that is why are we singling out used cars and not new cars? What's the difference there?
Chair Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Lucero. I will let Mr. Yakas, you know, talk more about that too. But, you know, for me, in my intention and, you know, really bringing this bill forward and just trying to help out folks who, you know, have the issue that, you know, were brought before us, who are looking, you know, they may not have the means to really get a new vehicle. And so, you know, when they're going out there and looking at vehicles that could be within their means, you know, mostly the folks that, you know, we have heard from today, that's why I think we're focusing on the used vehicle. But I'll let Mr. Yakas, who, you know, drafted the bill, talk more to that point.
Mr. Yakas.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Thank you, Chair Stevenson, Representative Lucero. To answer your question, we focused on the used car industry because that's related to the reports that we were getting at the council. And also because my experience has been dealing with new car dealerships is that they usually have their prices listed on the window or on the website. So the reports that were received by the council did not necessarily have a concern with new car dealerships.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And question number two, which I can just make a comment on. Well, actually, no, I will ask a question. The last testifier did also address the difference between, or the change that the amendment brought to the bill of prominently versus conspicuously. So could we have the bill author just provide what is the difference? Because in the great words of Rush Limbaugh, as we know, words mean things. And so clarity on the difference between prominently and conspicuously would be helpful.
Chair Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. This is, you know, like I said, bill language that we're still working through, and I will defer this to Mr. Yakas, who has helped me draft the bill, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Yakas.
Thank you, Chair Lee, Chair Stevenson, and Representative Lucero. So we changed that word as it was one of the concerns that the Auto Dealers Association brought to our attention, that word. However, we removed it. However, we also wanted to make sure that the price of the vehicle wasn't really displayed somewhere in a corner of the car or somewhere where it wasn't readily available to and easily accessible to the consumer. So that's the reason why we chose conspicuously.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I will ask the last question here instead of four questions. I'll just go to three. On line 1.11, it says on the vehicle's windshield. So it must be, the price must be in large print, and being one that, for example, a real estate agent, things are very specific as to the font, you know, the size of what the definition of large, small, medium font is. But I don't see that this is specified here what large is. But that being aside, on the vehicle's windshield. So back when I was a detailer for the Saturn dealership that used to and no longer exists in Moundsview, I would go through many of the used vehicles and detail the scratches and things off them. I can't even think of how many vehicles, very few actually had the used car price on the windshield, but instead it was a sticker on generally the driver's side rear window. And so is my understanding correct then that a sticker with the price on the driver's side rear window would not meet the requirements because it would not be on the windshield?
Surely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, Representative Lucero, I think this is something that, you know, if you have additional concern as the bill is being laid over, we could continue to have a conversation on to make sure that we are addressing, you know, some of the issues you have brought forth in your previous employment, and also some of the concerns that we have heard from the Minnesotans, the consumer, who just want some price transparency as we go forward. And if we need to make that a little bit more clear, I'm open to that as we consider this bill.
And just final remark, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that. I do appreciate Chair Lee's interest in transparency, and I absolutely share that goal. We definitely want Minnesotans to have transparency and full awareness of what they're getting consulting. But again, just obviously words matter and details matter. We want to make sure language is as clean as we can get it. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a couple of comments. I've got some confusion. As Representative Lucero just had pointed out, we did have a Minnesota law that was passed a number of years ago that requires used car dealers to say whether there is or isn't a warranty on the vehicle and to put some other information on a sticker that does need to appear in a vehicle. So we do have attempts to deal with some of those kinds of questions already that Chair Lee's bill brings forward. Second part of this is under federal law, the Truth in Lending Act, which promotes the informed use of consumer credit, it requires that you, if you're going to be advertising or promoting, you must disclose price. So I understand from testimony today that may not have been done. I don't necessarily need to have anyone tell me their experience on this, but I'm wondering why we aren't reporting these kinds of things to the CFPB, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, on the federal level. We recently expanded that after the housing crash in 08 to 2010 timeframe to attempt to try to expand consumer protection on here. And again, maybe it's rhetorical in nature, or I don't necessarily need to have an answer to it today, but why are we not using federal law right now? And where's federal law falling short? I understand no one wants to be taken advantage of, and I support that. I'm just wondering why our current laws are failing or aren't meeting the need. I'm just not seeing the connection here today, Mr. Chair. So those are my comments. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. With that, I see no other members seeking recognition. Chair Lee, any closing comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, community members, for the opportunity to present this bill as amended. And like I mentioned, you know, I'm willing to work with anyone who is interested in seeing what can we do if we are to move this forward. And I think to the last point made by Representative O'Driscoll, I think that's a valid point. And I would say that, you know, being someone who is from a family that have folks who doesn't speak English as a primary language, a lot of our, Minnesotans out there who may not speak English as a second, as a primary language, doesn't know that, you know, we have agencies, you know, whether that's federal agency or state agencies that are out there to protect them as consumers. And so that's why I think that, you know, it is our responsibility as a committee here and as a state to make sure that, you know, we provide resources necessary for these agencies to be able to carry out with the duties that we have tasked them to protect all Minnesotans, whether, you know, you're able to speak English or not. And so, Mr. Chair, really appreciate this opportunity to present this, and I renew my motion for this bill to be laid over, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Lee. And with that, we will lay over House File 2824 as amended. The next bill on our agenda is House File 2825 from Representative Hollins. Welcome to the committee, Representative Hollins. I will move that House File 2825 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Hollins, I understand you have the A22 amendment, and I will move the A22 amendment to get the bill in the shape that you'd like it to be considered. Any other description of that amendment, Representative Hollins?
No, Mr. Chair.
Any discussion to the A22 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Aye. The motion prevails and the A22 amendment is adopted. Representative Hollins, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members. I'm really honored to bring this bill here today. It's very simple, but I think it's incredibly important. It was brought to my attention that Minnesotans have been the victim of bad business practices when interacting with some car dealerships. And that some of those car dealerships will bring non-English speaking customers in with a bilingual salesperson, but then the financing part of the transaction will be done all in English. So this practice means that there are Minnesotans that are signing contracts that they don't fully understand, and potentially end up agreeing to some really egregious financing terms. And that obviously can result in their vehicles getting repossessed. It's a very unfair practice, and I do believe that it needs to stop immediately. So this bill would require that just a single language is used throughout the entire car buying transaction, and that single language could be English or any other language that an individual speaks. But it just ensures that all Minnesota consumers understand the terms of their financing, so they can plan accordingly, and creates a fair and level playing ground for that individual who is subject to, frankly, a lot of control within that financing. So I believe that this would protect Minnesotans against predatory practices, and I do have a couple of testifiers here today who I think will shed some light on this issue as well.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. The first testifier is Felipe Esquez. Mr. Esquez.
Hi, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Felipe Esquez. I am here on behalf of the Minnesota Council on Latino Affairs. And yes, we're obviously in full support of this bill. We're always in support of legislation that protects consumers, in particular on behalf of the council, Latino consumers, and consumers that speak more than one language or that are not primary English speakers. We have gotten reports at the council that in several instances, some dealerships will bring in Spanish-speaking consumers through a Spanish-speaking salesperson. However, and that's great. It's great that they're serving all Minnesotans. However, when it comes down to the financing, then all of a sudden that's done in English, such as in the example that was heard earlier in the hearing. And that's definitely unfair, because then people end up signing things that they just don't understand. And, all of a sudden they're surprised by, a change in their interest rate or, something that they were not necessarily expecting. There are different options that dealerships can utilize to comply with this. So, for example, if they already have Spanish speaking sales personnel, they can always train them in the financing process, or they can have them present during while the finance person is explaining everything to the consumer, or they can always use a translation line like we use in the medical field. So we're glad that you gave this bill a hearing, and we urge you to support it.
Thank you. The next testifier is Amber Backus. Ms. Backus.
Organized here, just one moment. Thank you. All right, Mr. Chair, members, Amber Backus with the Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association again. And as folks alluded to, the car buying process is unique in that multiple employees interact with the customer through the sales transaction. A salesperson will start the process and help the customer pick the best vehicle for them, while finance and insurance or F&I personnel will walk the customer through the financing and paperwork. Our member dealerships are working hard to diversify their workforce and hire employees who speak the primary language of the customers in the communities they serve. Most often, it's sales staff who are bi or multilingual. Under this bill, those talents would no longer be needed. Even if the dealership added F&I staff to continue the transaction in the same language, none of the mandated paperwork is available in any language except English. So by default, all transactions will be conducted in English only, having a chilling effect on diversity and inclusion efforts. And to Mr. Ayeska's point about having the salesperson then enter F&I, I think that would be a burden to those folks, as it would take away their opportunities to sell more vehicles, and they would lose commissions if they had to sit and translate for customers in the F&I office. Beyond that, the bill has a number of landmines for dealers. Since it applies to used sales only, what happens if a customer starts out looking for a new car and begins the transaction in Spanish or Somali, then decides partway through they'd prefer a used vehicle? Would a dealership have to turn that customer away? Even more concerning is the requirement that a dealership would have to ensure the customer understands the terms of the contract. How would a dealership satisfy this requirement? And why are vehicle purchases upheld to a different standard under contract law? I'm a native English speaker and sign contracts all the time when purchasing products, especially online these days. And I'm 100% confident there are terms I could not explain, but the seller isn't required to make sure I do. There's a longstanding presumption under the law that once a person signs a contract, they know that they were what they were agreeing to. If they did not, they should not have signed the contract. This bill turns that presumption on its head. Nor does the bill specify which contract is covered by this requirement. Is it the purchase agreement, the retail installment sales contract, an extended warranty, all of them? This really puts a burden on the dealerships that is unworkable. And for those reasons, we oppose House File 2825, but we would be willing to continue to work on language as we did provide suggestions earlier to make the bill workable. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Backus. I was just waiting to see if Mr. Ortega was getting on here, but I think we may just not be able to do that one. We'll move to member discussion and questions. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a couple questions for the bill author. The first one is, I've got my volume on. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first question is, it says in line 1.8, when engaging in a transaction to sell. So is this provision not applicable if the consumer is trading in a vehicle? So the dealer would be buying the vehicle from the consumer, that these provisions of single language agreement, et cetera, would not apply. Is it just when the dealer is selling a vehicle?
Are you asking about, you mentioned trade-in, which is kind of when they're both selling and buying. I just want to make sure the question, I understand your question clearly. Are you asking about when a dealer just purchases a car from a consumer or when there's a trade-in when they're conducting both a purchase and a sale?
So thank you, Mr. Chair. The plain language reads, when engaging in a transaction to sell a used motor vehicle, the dealer. So when the dealer is selling, so when the dealer is buying, do these, let's say they're buying only. Let's say a consumer is selling their vehicle to a used car dealer and not buying, so a trade-in would not be happening. But in the transaction of the dealer buying the vehicle, would this provision apply? And if not, why?
Okay, Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Lucero. I think you're asking, so would this apply if the dealer was buying a used car from someone, correct?
I believe that was the question.
Yep. Okay. No, my understanding as it's written currently is no, that would not apply in that situation.
Representative Lucero.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So then the follow-up to that is, why is it important that the dealer and the consumer engage in a negotiation to agree upon a single language when the dealer is selling the vehicle, but that same standard must not be met when buying the vehicle? Why did you only pick one?
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Lucero. I think that's a fair point. I mean, I think we would ultimately like to see, as we say in the law, a meeting of the minds. Where we all are on the same page about what transaction is going forward all of the time. So I do think that that is an opportunity for us to expand this rule to go even further. That being said, my understanding is that, this bit of legislation arose out of people's real lived experiences in trying to buy a used car and not in their experiences trying to sell a used car. But I certainly will turn it over to my testifier if he has any additional information about that.
Mr. Yeskis, any additional information?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lucero, no, nothing additional.
Representative Lucero, anything further?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then I guess it'd be the same question in regards to the previous bill. Also on line 1.8, it says, when engaging in a transaction to sell a used vehicle, so why did the bill author choose not to have this standard apply if a person is coming in to purchase a new vehicle?
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think my answer would be substantially the same as what Chair Lee had said, that we're really looking at where individuals who, don't speak English as a first language are purchasing vehicles. And that's not universally true, but the reports that we have heard, the reports that I have heard, have been coming from used car dealerships and not new car dealerships. And so that was the basis for that.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one last observation/question. On line 1.12, and I think the last testifier also brought it out, I see here the standard is that the dealer must ensure the consumer understands. So how, as the dealer sitting there, what is the objective standard by which a dealer can confirm that they have met the standard of ensure the consumer understands?
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Lucero. I mean, I think that is a tricky bit of language. I think it's difficult to ensure understanding in any situation. We have a lot of situations where we ask people, do you understand? And somebody simply nods and says that they do, even though we later find out that they don't. But in this particular situation, we're not asking that they understand, for instance, the legalese, but instead simply understand the terms of the contract in which they are signing. So really looking specifically like, do you understand that this is the percentage that it's going to be? This is how long a term it's going to be, et cetera. Not saying, I'm not expecting anybody to get a law degree here. I just want people to be able to understand the literal terms of the contract that they're agreeing to. Much like we do for student loans, when they go through the whole thing, I don't want to relive that trauma, but they go through piece by piece and they say, do you understand what you're taking on? And you have to say, yes, I do, before they will issue those student loans for you.
It is a traumatic experience. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just want to follow up. Yeah, so as I'm thinking about the other spheres that I operate in, I'll just use real estate as an example. How do I, if I'm trying to think of an objective standard by which somebody takes a pen and they sign their name before that happens, that they understand? Is that a nod of the head? Is it an audible, yes, I understand? Is it a written thing? Do they have to sign a document that they understand before they sign the contract document? Like, what is that standard? I think that's very important, because if that standard isn't met, it opens up the dealer to liability. And, I think that the language as it reads right now is very loose and is a very subjective standard. So I have huge concerns with that. So thank you.
Okay. I don't think there was a question in that one. So any further discussion or questions? Seeing none, Representative Hollins, any closing comments?
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, committee members. I do understand and respect where folks are coming from on this. But I also recognize that this is a loophole that is being taken advantage, that is taking advantage of consumers within Minnesota. And it's really unfortunate that we don't have a more robust system in place to be able to deal with this effectively. And I think that this bill really gets at that. So I would urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Hollins. With that, Representative Hollins, I'll renew my motion that House File 2825 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion. The bill as amended is laid over. The last bill on our agenda today is House File 2823. Welcome to the committee, Chair Noor. I will move House File 2823 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Chair Noor has the A22 amendment. I will move the A22 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like it considered. Chair Noor, would you like to describe that amendment any further?
I know that's the way I would like the bill to present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any discussion to the A22 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Chair Noor, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members, for allowing me to present this bill. As you all are aware of, there's a lot of challenges that you've been talking or discussing about, vehicles and cars and whatnot. Can you imagine that you are dealing with a life and death situation, and you come out from your home and the only accessible transportation is for you to have a vehicle that is reliable. And unfortunately, that vehicle can no longer start for you. This is what I call when a kill switch is included in that vehicle, and at no instance of giving you heads up that that vehicle is no longer accessible to you. Madam Chair and members, that's what is happening when it comes to used cars dealership and many other dealership who usually insert or include with your vehicle something called a kill switch, which is a GPS whereby the consumer protection is under threat, meaning that they can track where you are at any time, at anywhere, and use that kill switch for whatever reason that they feel best fit. And let me tell you this, the only time that you're made aware of is when the consumer pays for that kill switch. But when the dealership adds the kill switch to the vehicle, there's no way that will be disclosed to you until you face the challenge of being left out. Maybe you have taken your kids to a daycare and you come out and it's no longer available to you, and many other circumstances. So this bill requires at any time before you sign the credit information that the disclosure be given to you that there'll be a kill switch and for which circumstances that kill switch will be used. So this is more about consumer protection and making sure the privacy of that individual is protected. But this happens under the knowledge of the person who's purchasing that vehicle. Mr. Chair, I have testifiers with me who would like to testify on this bill.
Thank you, Chair Noor. The first testifier is Felipe Ilescas. Sorry, Mr. Ilescas. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Chair Noor, for being our chief author on this bill. Yes, the Council on Internal Affairs has received several reports of constituents. Sorry, I should have mentioned this before, but the Council on Latino Affairs is a state agency that represents the interests of all Latinos in Minnesota, individuals, businesses, veterans, whatnot. So that's who the council is. The council received reports of consumers that have experienced exactly that what Mr. Chair Noor just described. They had purchased a vehicle. They were not made aware that the vehicle had this device that can disable the car remotely. And so then they would go into a store, come back out, and all of a sudden the car wasn't starting. And that's because either they had missed a payment or, you know, and which again, fine, that's valid. However, they should know that can happen. They should know when the device will be used so that they can also know what they should be doing in order to avoid their car being disabled. In addition to that, all of a sudden the tow truck would show up. And so then that means that they're also tracking the vehicle. Some states have actually had efforts to ban this device in those states. We're not going for that. I mean, it's a tool that the dealerships use and that's fine. And it brings reassurance that people will make their payments. All we're saying is we need full disclosure that consumers need to know that this device exists within the car, regardless of who's paying for it and when the device will be used, so that they can, again, know what to do in order to avoid their car being disabled.
Thank you. The next testifier is Amber Backus. Ms. Backus.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair and members. Amber Backus of the Minnesota Automobile Dealers Association. I did have the opportunity to talk with Representative Noor about the bill on Monday, and he shared with me that other states have similar laws on the books. That gave me the opportunity to do some research, and I came across at least six other states that do: California, Colorado, Connecticut, Nevada, New Jersey, and New York. Most of these were enacted around 2017. However, I noticed a big distinction between those bills and what is proposed here in House File 2823. In those bills, the creditor or lender who has the ability to stop the vehicle is responsible for making the disclosure, not the dealer. And most of these other states, the device is narrowly defined. Those states also provide notification for when the device will be used, as well as restrict the policy of when it's used for tracking. But unfortunately, this bill emulates none of those other provisions from other states. This bill requires all dealers to make a disclosure about whether a vehicle does or does not have a GPS starter interruption device. And the definition of GPS starter interrupt device is so broad, it could include all kinds of devices: OnStar, telemetric devices provided by insurance companies, devices bought online and added by a parent of a teenager. How is the dealer supposed to know whether, with certainty, a trade-in has one of these devices if it were added by a third party? How would a dealer know all the instances or circumstances under which the device could be used, as is required on lines 2.19 to 2.20 of the delete all, since the breadth of devices and their capabilities are so broad? Furthermore, the delete all amendment requires the dealer to provide a written disclosure and obtain the customer's signature, quote, prior to a consumer filling out a credit application for a used motor vehicle, unquote. If the consumer fills out the credit application at a bank or credit union before they even step foot in the dealership, there's no way a dealership could comply with this requirement, unless, of course, they have a psychic on staff. If the target of the bill is buy here, pay here lots, let's target the bill to them so their customers are fully informed, as we did in the proposed amendments we provided. As drafted now, the bill before you creates a number of impossible hoops for dealerships to jump through and adds unnecessary disclosures that diminish the relevance of existing ones that are more important to all car buyers. Thank you. And again, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Backus. This concludes public testimony on this file. We'll turn to member discussion and questions. Any discussion to the bill? Seeing none, any closing comments? Chair Noor.
Thank you, Mr. Chen, members. This is purely about consumer protection, whether the use of the GPS or the kill switch. I will ask for your support and look forward to working on this bill to make sure that we can have a comprehensive bill, as the advocates have already stated. So thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members, for your support.
Thank you, Chair Noor. And I will renew my motion that House File 2823, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. The bill, as amended, is laid over. And as an aside for committee members and testifiers, I think we saw three bills today, all of which are trying to get at a good idea, but perhaps all of which need a little bit more work, which is exactly what the committee process is for. So that's why we have laid the bills over, and will allow the authors to continue to work on them and hopefully see them again later in the year. Representative O'Driscoll, I see that you are seeking recognition.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just was wondering if you'd give members and the public a little bit of an idea of what the lay of the land might look like. We're almost finished, although at least this committee is finished. Well, I take that back. We've got Friday with another hearing, but normally we'd be done with our committee work. What next week and the following week might look like, if you have some insight for committee members and for the public.
Yeah, we have a few more weeks left. So later this week on Friday, we do have a hearing posted in which I intend for this committee to take up a liquor bill. And we will have that for the public to look at, hopefully within a day here, well in advance of the hearing. We have a few other bills on the agenda for Friday as well. And then that will take us to first deadline. Next week, of course, is second deadline week, when we will consider bills that have had hearings in the Senate, but not yet in the House. And we have a full slate of bills on our normal committee times that week. Following that, I do expect to assemble a omnibus commerce bill that I expect to both have finance and policy components to it. And I expect that will happen the week after next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are you planning additional committee meetings at this time as well for planning purposes?
At this time, I have no plans to add bill hearings beyond the Friday hearing this week. So I would expect a meeting at our usual time next week and the week following. I will note that there is some possibility that after third deadline, we might do some informational, I should say, an informational hearing on a couple subjects. There's been a couple bills that there's been some interest in, and I think could be some utility in, but nothing firmly decided. But I certainly will apprise you, as is my usual practice, Representative Driscoll, if the need arises for any additional committee hearings.
And Mr. Chair, I want to publicly thank you for your partnership in keeping us informed about what the agenda is. And I think that we've had some pretty organized and thoughtful and fruitful discussions because we have been able to work together in that capacity. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Driscoll. And I also want to thank you for our constructive relationship. I think that we have done a good job on this committee over the last 2 years, and I appreciate that very much. With that, our agenda for today is concluded and the meeting is adjourned.